The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you to Richard Palmer for filling in for me yesterday. There's a lot going on here at Edstone at this time of year. We've got our youth camp beginning in just a little over a week, so lots of work, lots of planning, lots of details to be sorting out. So, as I say, I appreciate Richard stepping in. I know he's been pretty busy too, with lots of work in the IT department and with editorial. In any event, we have got a lot to get to today. The Republican convention is now over, finally. It had quite a bit of drama, particularly on the third day. We'll focus more on the finale last night here in just a little bit. Of course, the Democrats are ready to roll with their convention next week. But on today's show, we'll be breaking down Donald Trump's speech from last night and consider what type of president he would be should he win in November. Also today, if we have time, we'll get through a few emails that have come in after since Wednesday's program, the one there at the end in which we talked about Verdi's opera, The Troubadour. Hopefully we'll also have time to play one more opera selection recommended by one of you, our dear listeners. So if we have time for that at the end, you'll want to stay tuned for it. Well, I'll begin, before we get into some of the excerpts from Donald Trump's speech, let me just start with Daniel Henninger's piece at the Wall Street Journal, A Nation at Half-Mast. We'll come back to this toward the end of the segment. But here's how he sets up his piece. He says, the Wall Street Journal NBC poll reports that 73% of the electorate believes the United States is on the wrong track. Three-quarters of the United States, we're on the wrong track. He says it's a level normally associated with national crises, such as the 2008 financial meltdown. Amid the GOP convention in Cleveland, and with the Democratic mothership landing next week in Philadelphia, one has to wonder, are the campaigns of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton also on the wrong track? You think of Joel Hilliker's piece from a couple of months ago about how that the winner in this competition for president will most likely be the one that is hated the least. That's what it's boiled down to for these two campaigns. Are both of them on the wrong track? Well, Donald Trump gave his vision of the future last night at the final day of the Republican convention in Cleveland. And, of course, to many political commentators in the media, Trump's speech was dark and angry. It was a scary speech. But to the ones listening in the room, all of the GOP's faithful, the Trumpsters, as sometimes they're called, to them, this was an awesome speech. This was a speech that was right on target. And early on in the speech, at least with respect to identifying America's many problems, you could say the speech definitely did hit the target, especially early on, as I say. This is a sampling. This is clip one from last night.
What about our economy? Again, I will tell you the plain facts that have been edited out of your nightly news and your morning newspaper. Nearly 4 in 10 African American children are living in poverty, while 58% of African American youth are now not employed. 2 million more Latinos are in poverty today than when President Obama took his oath of office less than 8 years ago. Another 14 million people have left the workforce entirely. Household incomes are down more than $4,000 since the year 2000. That's 16 years ago. Our trade deficit in goods reached nearly, think of this, our trade deficit is $800 billion. Yeah, think of that. $800 billion. Last year alone, we're going to fix that. The budget is no better. President Obama has almost doubled our national debt to more than $19 trillion and growing. And yet, what do we have to show for it? Our roads and bridges are falling apart. Our airports are third world condition. And 43 million Americans are on food stamps.
Now, I should note that this is Donald Trump on a teleprompter. He's not quite as eloquent sounding as he is when he's just speaking off the cuff. That's what so many of his supporters absolutely love. But if you go and just read the transcript of this speech, there's some sections of it that are really quite good and that are packed with facts, as he just spelled out there all of the just how much worse it is today than it was 7.5 years ago. Rising unemployment, household incomes down, the trade deficit, $800 billion. And then, as we talked about last week, the national debt, how that's doubled during the Obama administration to over $19 trillion. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and more people leaving the workforce, and more people, more Americans signing up for food stamps. It's not a pretty picture. America today. And he did a good job last night, even if he maintained a similar tone all the way through the 75-minute speech. Still, the facts and figures that he brings out, some of it, as I say, was quite good. Here's another clip from last night, clip two.
We all remember the images of our sailors being forced to their knees by their Iranian captors at gunpoint. This was just prior to the signing of the Iran deal, which gave back to Iran $150 billion and gave us absolutely nothing. It will go down in history as one of the worst deals ever negotiated.
He definitely got that right. My father called the Iran nuke deal the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. The worst in America's history. And to think, as I noted a week or two ago, that all of that happened, or at least the deal was finalized on January the 16th. And then you had all the drama with the prisoners. The kidnappings, well, actually, the prisoner that he's talking about there, the two naval vessels, those were seized even days before the nuke deal. And we all remember those images, those sailors being forced to their knees, those sailors and America with them being humiliated. As I say, he was right about that, and he's also right about a lot of this history. Here he talks about Hillary Clinton's role in this, especially with respect to the Obama administration's foreign policy. This is clip three.
In 2009, pre-Hillary, ISIS was not even on the map. Libya was stable. Egypt was peaceful. Iraq was seeing and really a big, big reduction in violence. Iran was being choked by sanctions. Syria was somewhat under control. After 4 years of Hillary Clinton, what do we have? ISIS has spread across the region and the entire world. Libya is in ruins, and our ambassador and his staff were left helpless to die at the hands of savage killers. Egypt was turned over to the radical Muslim Brotherhood, forcing the military to retake control. Iraq is in chaos. Iran is on the path to nuclear weapons. Syria is engulfed in a civil war, and a refugee crisis now threatens the West. After 15 years of wars in the Middle East, after trillions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost, the situation is worse than it has ever been before. This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton: death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness.
And what he spelled out there pretty much is that the world is on fire, and it is. Now, this is not solely the fault of Hillary Clinton. As you know, if you've been studying Bible prophecy, if you're familiar with the United States and Britain in prophecy, the United States has been on this downward spiral long before President Obama showed up. I mean, he definitely has a hand, along with his administration, in accelerating so much of this, for sure, as Mr. Trump brings out there. But nowhere in this speech, really, did you get to root causes of America's problems. It's easy to point the finger at your political opponent. But what is the problem? That's spelled out in quite a bit of detail in the United States and Britain in prophecy. And it shows where we're headed because of our many sins. It's like Mr. Armstrong said, we played this clip for you, I think a week ago. This is clip 12.
This world is on fire. This world is in trouble. This world is in trouble such as the world has never been before. And there are even greater troubles coming yet until God Almighty steps in to end these troubles and to come and save us from ourselves.
See, that's the truth. That's the sobering truth here, is that these troubles are going to intensify no matter who wins in November. He sees the problems, so many of them, Mr. Trump. But what are the solutions? No political party gives you that. And really, neither one of them give you the cause either. This world is on fire, as Mr. Armstrong said. It's in trouble. It's headed right to great tribulation, as Matthew 24 brings out. A time of trouble that was not since the beginning of the world to this time, as Jesus said. That's what's recorded there in the Gospels. Daniel 12:1 also says, a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Now, we can't just suppose or turn a blind eye to these prophecies, supposing they don't really exist or they don't really mean what they say. Too many people pretend that these prophecies don't exist or that they don't apply to our day. I've talked before about how the churches of this world typically ignore Bible prophecy, even though it makes up 1/3 of the Bible. Imagine that. Why would you turn a blind eye to that third? I mean, that's the third that tells us what's to happen in the latter days. In Matthew 24, the disciples came to Christ and said, show us, tell us, spell it out. What's going to happen in the latter days? When are you going to return to this earth? When will this present evil world come to an end? And read it for yourself in Matthew 24 or in Luke 21 or in Mark 13. See what Jesus said. See what Jesus prophesied for the last days. Some people will talk about Jesus, but will they refer to this Olivet prophecy? Will they talk about the prophecies that Jesus spoke? Not very many. You're only going to get it on this program. You're only going to get it at thetrumpet.com. You're only going to get it at the Trumpet magazine, at the Key of David. But as I say, in the case of Mr. Trump in identifying all of these problems, and there are a lot of them. It's easy to focus the real intensity of his wrath on Hillary Clinton. Well, he seems to be doing that now, but he's also focused a lot of that wrath on Ted Cruz and some others, even in his own party. But here's what he had to say about Mrs. Clinton last night. This is clip 4.
And when a Secretary of State illegally stores her emails on a private server, deletes 33,000 of them so the authorities can't see her crime, puts our country at risk, lies about it in every different form, and faces no consequence, I know that corruption has reached a level like never, ever before in our country. When the FBI director says that the Secretary of State was extremely careless and negligent in handling our classified secrets, I also know that these terms are minor compared to what she actually did. They were just used to save her from facing justice for her terrible, terrible crimes. In fact, her single greatest accomplishment may be committing such egregious crime and getting away with it, especially when others who have done far less have paid so dearly.
Now, that's a message that resonates with a lot of people in America. I guess, to be specific, about half the country that see this level of corruption like never before, as Trump brings out there. He had quite a few sound bites for his supporters. Here's another one that, again, it's hard to pick apart or disagree with. It's clip 6 about what he said regarding law enforcement.
An attack on law enforcement is an attack on all Americans.
That's true. It really is an attack on the rule of law in America. It's an attack on all Americans. And he goes on to say after that that, well, he's going to be the law and order president. He's going to restore law and order to America's streets. But the thing is, what does the Bible say? What does the Bible say about what is to be happening on America's streets in the very last days? In the very early days of the Great Tribulation, in fact, as we've covered in recent programs, going through Isaiah 1, going through Ezekiel 4, going through Ezekiel 5. And so you can, again, he's not alone in someone that's able to identify the many problems. But what you don't hear, what you never hear, is the cause. And what you don't hear, what you never hear, is the real solution. This world is in trouble. This world is in trouble. And those troubles are multiplying, not just in the United States, all over the world. But as you would expect with any campaign season, of course, the politician that comes forward, well, he or she, they're just the answer. They're the solution. We've heard this so many times before, haven't we? And yet, look at what keeps happening each 4-year cycle or each 8-year cycle. Is one politician going to be able to turn this around? When you think about what the Bible says about not placing your trust in a man, notice here what he had to say about the rigged system, something that he's talked about at length in his political stump speeches. This is clip number 5.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it. I have seen firsthand how the system is rigged against our citizens, just like it was rigged against Bernie Sanders. He never had a chance, never had a chance. But his supporters will join our movement because we will fix his biggest single issue, trade deals that strip our country of its jobs and strip us of our wealth as a country. Millions of Democrats will join our movement because we are going to fix the system so it works fairly and justly for each and every American.
Now, just a couple of things here. I thought that was actually a revealing comment. Firstly, the first part where he talks about nobody knows the system better than me. I mean, he knows the system. He's played the system. It's interesting to me that the people in the audience there were chuckling after he said that. Nobody knows the system better than me. I mean, he hasn't been a politician until the last year, but he certainly has been active in politics. He certainly has been influential in politics, particularly on the Democrat side. He's only recently switched over the last couple of years, I guess. But nobody knows the system better than me, which, as he went on to say, which is why I alone can fix it. He's been a part of this mess for decades. And now he's sure, and his supporters are sure that he can fix everything, that he can fix what's broken. Can he fix it? This world is on fire. This world is in trouble. It's dangerous, isn't it? And we heard it 8 years ago, that same kind of overconfidence. That same kind of vain speaking. I alone can fix it. He's the only one that can fix it. What must God think of statements like that? I'm the only one that can fix this problem. No one else can. It's just me. I thought it was also revealing, particularly given what happened Wednesday night, where he makes another plea for the supporters of Bernie Sanders, reaching out to them. The system was rigged against him as well. His supporters are going to join the Trump movement. Millions of them are going to join Trump. And this comes the night after the Trump team basically set up Ted Cruz for the ambush on Wednesday night. Just crazy, the big stories that come out of conventions like this. Here Cruz, probably the most conservative of the bunch, he agreed to speak at the convention, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago, after being assured that he could say what he wanted to say. And then it was 3 or 4 days before the convention that he told Donald Trump that he wouldn't come out and offer his full endorsement. Or he wouldn't say, I'm definitely endorsing Trump this fall. And so you had a lot of news outlets. National Review was saying there about a full day before Cruz gave his speech that there would be no open endorsement coming from Cruz. And then Cruz turned in his speech hours before the final version of his speech. He gave it to Mr. Trump. He gave it to Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort. It was approved. Even Trump acknowledged this in a tweet after the speech, that he knew there wouldn't be a full endorsement. And then, you know, I'm sure some of you, particularly in the States, you know about the big blow-up there at the end of Mr. Cruz's speech, where he talked about voting according to your conscience and the booing. And then he basically was booed off stage. Paul Manafort all but admitted that they had Trump operatives in the crowd during the speech to start the booing, to start the chants. And really, just looking at it from a political standpoint, many people have talked about how that this hurts Cruz's career. Cruz is out of the picture right now. He's not even running for office. But it leaves you scratching your head just looking at it maybe as a political pundit would or should, that here he is in the Republican Party alienating the avid supporters of Ted Cruz, alienating the Never Trump movement. How big it is, who knows, but it certainly represents a significant chunk of voters. And how that you would be willing to just run them off instead of trying to bring them in doesn't seem to make sense to me from a political standpoint. But when you hear the comment that he made last night about the millions and millions of Bernie Sanders supporters, Bernie Sanders is as far left as you can get. And Donald Trump has reached out to his supporters multiple times, but not Ted Cruz. In fact, he said months ago that he didn't need him. He didn't need Ted Cruz supporters. I think it gives us some insight into where he really is in the political spectrum. Nobody knows the system better than he does. Remember that. Nobody knows it better than him. And he alone is the one to fix it. Pretty amazing statement. Well, carrying on here, this is a statement he made about NATO in the speech last night as well. This is clip 7.
Recently, I have said that NATO was obsolete because it did not properly cover terror, and also that many of the member countries were not paying their fair share. As usual, the United States has been picking up the cost.
And so he's been harping on this, as you know, that NATO is obsolete and that everybody else doesn't pay their fair share. It all falls on the back of the United States. And this speech comes just a day or two after he gave a 45-minute interview to the New York Times, in which he basically said, you know, if those Baltic countries up in Northern Europe, if they're attacked by Russia, well, we're going to have to wait to come to their defense and make sure that they've been paying their way and to make sure that they've been contributing. This is from that New York Times piece, July 20th, just the other day, a couple days ago. Donald J. Trump, on the eve of accepting the Republican nomination for president, explicitly raised new questions on Wednesday about his commitment to automatically defending NATO allies if they are attacked, saying he would first look at their contributions to the alliance. And so Article 5 of the agreement, the NATO agreement, is that if one of the members is attacked, the others will rise in defense of that member. And so here he is the day before his speech yesterday, saying that he'd first look at their contributions. The New York Times says, asked about Russia's threatening activities, which have unnerved the small Baltic states that are among the more recent entrants into NATO, Mr. Trump said that if Russia attacked them, he would decide whether to come to their aid only after reviewing if those nations had fulfilled their obligations to us. Only after a review. In other words, Russia could just waltz right in there with all of its troops. And then American officials under a Trump administration would huddle together to see if they were worth defending. The little Baltic states, that is. The New York Times says Mr. Trump's statement appeared to be the first time that a major candidate for president had suggested conditioning the United States defense on its major allies. It was consistent, however, with his previous threat to withdraw American forces from Europe and Asia if those allies fail to pay more for American protection. If you don't help pay or support this financially, we're getting out. And here again, this is a message, I think, too, that resonates with lots of Americans. But look at the bigger picture here. What happens in Europe if America's presence is gone? And what are the people of Latvia and Estonia? What are they thinking about the possibility of a Trump administration? Those little nations have lots of ethnic Russians, just like Ukraine does. And with respect to Ukraine, of course, Vladimir Putin used that as an excuse for Russian expansionism. Well, there's Russians there, and they're being mistreated. And so we need to intervene. You have all these little Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They're right in the way of Russia's connection to Kaliningrad. Russia would love nothing more than to have a land bridge that takes Russia proper over to its little enclave there in Kaliningrad. But here, these small nations in Northern Europe, they now see Russian submarines off their coast. They see Russian bombers doing test runs. They're seeing things off their coast that they haven't seen since the end of World War II, since the end of the Cold War. So still, I mean, that's 20-some years, 26 years or so. They're seeing things off their shores that are very disturbing. The New York Times asked pointedly, if Russia came over the border into Estonia or Latvia, Lithuania, places that Americans don't think about all that often, would you come to their immediate military aid? And his response, well, we'd have to see if they fulfilled their obligations first. I mean, this is a position that not even President Obama has ever suggested or taken. That, well, if that happens, we might fail to honor Article 5 of the NATO alliance. It's interesting that after that article appeared yesterday, or I guess it was Wednesday, the Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort, he tried to back away from the piece, saying that, well, the Times misquoted Mr. Trump. And then the New York Times responded to that charge by publishing the full transcript of the interview, which said what the article said. But coming back to that article, it says here, within hours of Mr. Trump's remarks calling into question whether, as president, he would automatically defend NATO allies, European officials, who were already nervous about American commitments, appeared a little stunned by his comments. That's how the European officials reacted to that interview with the New York Times. It's no wonder. It's no wonder that Germany, coming out with its white paper, is now making bold proclamations. Well, we've got to step forward. We've got to lead. We've got to shape the global order. Look at this world. Look at how unsettled it is. We're feeling the impact of these crises, these conflicts, Chancellor Merkel said at the start of that white paper. We're experiencing that peace and stability are not a matter of course, even in Europe. There's another article here from Time Magazine, time.com, interviewing a Supreme Allied commander about how wrong Donald Trump is about NATO. It says here, the world has seen many failed alliances, from the League of Nations to the Warsaw Pact. We should all hope that NATO does not become one of them. I mean, that's what's happening. That's where this is leading. And yet, with the European Union coming under fire from many corners, including the recent Brexit vote in the UK, recent fears about the aggression of Russia in the Ukraine, criticism of NATO expansion, and Donald Trump even saying that NATO's obsolete, we're seeing signs that the enduring fabric of the last decades of the Western world may be starting to fray. You keep hearing this, how the world order is being violently shaken. And what has been maintained since the end of World War II? Well, it's starting to unravel. It says here on Wednesday, Trump told the New York Times that we should not respond to an attack on an ally unless we review whether it had met its obligations to us. And it says here, picture a budget-based review of Estonia's contributions while Russian troops are pouring into the nation. What kind of foreign policy is this? Well, hey, let's get together. The troops are pouring in, but let's get together for this budget-based review. It says, ironically, healthy alliances are exactly what we need to manage the world's increasing turbulence and danger. I mean, even Mr. Trump, as I said, in identifying many of the crises, he's spot on. The turbulence, the danger. But does this help the situation when you back away from Europe and when you let a German-dominated Europe fend for itself against Russia? I mean, we're talking about major power players here. And with little or no U.S. influence or involvement, is that going to make the world a better and safer place? Put America first. That's the theme of this potential presidency. But how does America come out first when it withdraws? We've already seen what happened in the Middle East because of that. Under the Obama administration, the backpedaling, the retreating, the withdrawal. This is what he said, Mr. Trump, that is, on Turkey. This is from that New York Times article. It says, Mr. Trump had nothing but praise for President Erdogan, the country's increasingly authoritarian but democratically elected leader. I give great credit to him for being able to turn that around. He's an authoritarian tyrant. And Trump had high praise for him, handling that coup. Asked if Mr. Erdogan was exploiting the coup attempt to purge his well, we don't need to read all of it, but I think what's most important in this part, or in this story, in this development, is the fact, as I said the other day, that the United States has a major air base in Sirlik, right there in Turkey. It uses that base to carry out strikes against the Islamic State or wherever. It has a force of drones there on that base. And it also has about 50 nuclear weapons. Just a small air base where there's a fair bit of activity, but it's certainly not a well-fortified air base. And it's right there in the midst of this country, Turkey, where there's all this turmoil. Brent Noctegal had an article today at thetrumpet.com. Turkey enters a dark new age. And he shows how that this coup is giving Erdogan the chance to purge that nation of any form of resistance. It's becoming a radicalist state. Erdogan himself, he said, whether he was behind the coup or not, he called it a gift from God. This is his chance to cleanse the army, to cleanse the judicial branch, to cleanse the political scene in Turkey of any form of resistance. Now, how about these some 50 nuclear weapons? We've talked about this before as well. I'll refer to my dad's article, January 2014 Trumpet, Europe's Nuclear Secret. I mean, here's all these nuclear weapons, 150, 200 of them throughout Europe, Germany and elsewhere, also Turkey. Foreign policy. It talks about America's nukes, how that they're not safe in Turkey anymore. It says here there are a few dozen U.S. B-61 nuclear gravity bombs stored in Incirlik. Does it seem like a good idea to station American nuclear weapons at an airbase commanded by someone who may have just helped bomb his own country's parliament? What a world. It's on fire. It's on fire. This world is full of trouble, as Mr. Armstrong said. Foreign policy says here the weapons at Incirlik are stored in vaults in the floor of the protective aircraft shelters. The shelters are inside a security perimeter. The U.S. and its NATO allies recently invested $160 million on security upgrades. You know about the security. We've had a recent program on this about just how much of a joke it is. Just some random civilian walking in with his camera to film these nukes. Nuclear weapons in Turkey. It says at the same time, if a hostile junta were to seize control of a country with U.S. nuclear weapons stationed in it, things might be dicier. An airbase is not a fortress, it says. Later on, it says, so while the precautions to protect U.S. nuclear weapons at Incirlik are reasonable, they are based on a series of assumptions about the stability and friendliness of the country. See, what about the stability of Turkey? What about its friendliness or lack thereof? It says the security situation in Turkey has been deteriorating for some time. Earlier this year, the Department of Defense evacuated military and civilian families from Incirlik, citing concerns about terrorist threats. Can you imagine that? The Department of Defense evacuating military and civilian families from this airbase that has 50 nuclear weapons, 50 nuclear bombs. Given the general climate of instability, you might ask why U.S. nuclear weapons are even stored in Turkey in the first place. Well, that's especially relevant because one of the peculiar things about U.S. gravity bombs in Turkey is that there are no planes available to deliver them. In other words, Incirlik is a glorified storage depot. It's just a storage facility. There's no planes even to deliver those nuclear weapons. And so there they are, just sitting there in storage. Just sitting there in storage. Should they be sitting there? Are they safe in this world today that's on fire? In this world of trouble, are those weapons safe? Well, I've got more here from foreign policy, but I'm running out of time. Let me just fast forward here to another clip from last night. This is Donald Trump, again, clip number 8.
I have made billions of dollars in business making deals. Now I'm going to make our country rich again.
And so there again is the slogan in its many forms. He's going to make America great again. He alone is able to fix the rigged system. He's going to make America safe again. He's going to restore law and order to the streets. He's going to make America rich again. All those problems, all that debt, all the trade imbalance, he'll fix everything. Here's what he said about China, clip 10.
We are going to enforce all trade violations against any country that cheats. This includes stopping China's outrageous theft of intellectual property, along with their illegal product dumping and their devastating currency manipulation. They are the greatest that ever came about. They are the greatest currency manipulators ever.
The greatest currency manipulators ever. Huge trade imbalance. China's outrageous behavior. It's tough talk. But what does Bible prophecy foretell? What does Ezekiel 5 say? My father's talked about, well, it's in the recent trumpet, an issue or two ago, China steering the world toward war. It says here, you already see this prophecy moving toward fulfillment, the prophecy of Ezekiel 5, that is. The European Union moving into South America, making trade agreements that are taking business away from the U.S., and then Russia and China militarizing the most important trade routes traversing the Asian continent. Prophecy is being fulfilled before our eyes. America's enemies are securing shipping lanes and creating economic alliances that will very soon enable them to choke off America's supply lines. Soon, America will find it impossible to import oil and other necessities. See, those foreign enemies, they are going to punish the United States because our nations, as he says earlier in the article, they're full of terrible sins. And God is going to correct us for that. That's the truth. That's the truth that you don't hear at any political convention. One final clip here from the speech last night. This is clip 9.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
LGBT is not enough. Now you've got to add Q to the acronym. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. That's who he's going to protect. He's going to do everything in his power to protect that community. It's like Tim Stanley said at the Telegraph, Donald Trump is the perfect candidate for today's debased and wounded America. Stanley says the religious right is over. God stayed at home. Ted Cruz was perhaps the only speaker at his convention to attack abortion. This is the Republican convention, after all. Gay rights is suddenly super duper. Trump talked not only about LGBT people, but even departed from his leaked draft to add a Q at the end. It says Trump has stripped all the culture war out of the GOP, and much of the Reaganite economics is gone too. The Constitution hardly raised its ghostly head. Social benefits will be protected. We heard Democrat-style promises of equal pay for women and labor law reform. I mean, this is a synopsis of the entire convention. Free trade is bad now. Even foreign wars, even NATO are obsolete. The emphasis now is on hunting terrorists abroad and restoring law and order at home. That's it. And you can add to that the money angle. Well, if it'll benefit us financially, if it'll benefit us with, as far as money goes, then we'll consider it. It's amazing. Some people heard an echo of Richard Nixon in his deafening sales pitch. They're wrong, says Stanley. Yes, Trump has acknowledged that he sees Nixon's 1968 presidential campaign as a model, a campaign that won on a promise to bring order to America's inner cities. That was a time of turmoil for America, the late 60s. And Nixon came in largely because he said, I'm going to restore law and order. Stanley, though, says here, Watergate has dimmed our view of Nixon. But he never swore in public. This is Nixon. He treated his wife with great courtesy, upheld ancient Republican ideals on civil rights, and truly believed in public service. That Nixon would have lost the primaries, or rather that Nixon would have lost the primaries to Trump, because America has changed. It's changed. Their faith in government is gone. Their religion has become less theological and more cultural. Their culture is debased. Nixon stormed out of West Side Story because he thought it distasteful. Today, hardcore sex and violence are freely available on TV and the internet. Celebrities are the new tawdry gods. Even conservatives have become uglier. They mount vile, racist, and sexist campaigns on Twitter. They're shameless. They have little Christian sense of guilt. That's the new America today that this candidate vows to defend, LGBT and Q as well. Well, we'll see what happens in 3.5 months. But all of this certainly makes you just relieved that you don't participate, that we don't participate in these kinds of movements of men. There's no hope in man, as the Bible says. No hope. Well, we'll take a short break here before coming back. Hopefully we have a few minutes left to play that track from another opera. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
The Trumpet Daily.
Some great emails coming in response to the program on Wednesday. This first one here, I've been to a few operas here in Canada. My absolute favorite is The Magic Flute. I remember being captivated just by the overture. The production that we saw presented it in a more comical light. Sometimes they're done a little more as a dark interpretation. And then she goes on and says here that there's a book by Don Freeman, the author of Corduroy, that is called Maestro Petrini, that basically is a cute little book for introducing kids to opera. So that's something that you might want to consider, you parents out there with little ones. The book Maestro Petrini by Don Freeman. This next one here from Canada. What a great and encouraging program. Thank you for including the clips of the opera. It's amazing how opera music has such a stigma attached to it that it's the one music genre people tend to steer away from. I loved it. I cranked it up while I was doing some household chores. And then finally, another one from Canada. Still enjoying the program while I exercise, including the opera portions. I grew up listening to opera whenever my dad played it occasionally. If you want to hear an awesome 3-minute piece that will make your hair stand on end, try this one. Luciano Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma from the opera Turandot. I probably mispronounced all of that, but it's by Puccini. The one I have is with, well, he explains what his is from. But with that, we will conclude this program, and we will conclude this week with that piece sung by Luciano Pavarotti. Thanks for that tip from one of you dear listeners. That's Luciano Pavarotti singing one that you've no doubt heard before. You know you love it. You children listening, you know you love it as well. Thanks for the email feedback. Thanks for the tips. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Keep sending those emails, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today and this week. We'll see you next week.